and 7. And I see there are a lot of people here. I think many people will be here for the public hearings and work session on 2180 and 2469. And as you can see on the agenda, we will be hearing 2700 first. So if you don't mind sitting through that, you're welcome to stay. Okay, I open up the work session on 2700. Andy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2700, to summarize what the measure would do. It would require health benefit plans in the state to include coverage for contraception. It would require hospitals to inform victims of sexual assaults about emergency contraception and treatment options, and to provide emergency contraception upon request. It would also require the Department of Human Services to develop informational materials, and it would prohibit public bodies from interfering with consenting individuals' access to contraception.
Thank you, Andy. Colleagues, we have several amendments, which you should have gotten yesterday afternoon. Did anybody have a problem with that? Everybody got them? Susan? Everybody got them, I think, right? Everybody here got them. Oh, you're going to put them? Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Representative... Oh, here comes the late Representative Olson.
The late? What happened? I haven't heard yet.
Thank you.
Good to know
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Representative Maurer, I think you have a couple of amendments.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2700 be amended with the -3 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Maurer amends House Bill 2700 with the -3 amendments. Do you want to talk with us about that, Representative Maurer?
Yes, Madam Chair. The -3 amendments makes several changes in a couple areas, and I'm going to highlight just a couple of them. One is the on the amendment, line 4 and 5, specifically, it talks about inserting licensed medical provider with hospitals providing care. I know that the state of Washington, that the law says hospital, and that that there have been concerns that hospitals don't provide care, people provide care, and so... It's really a change of responsibility from the hospital who provides the facility to the licensed medical provider who actually is in charge of treatments. That's one change. And then I'm going to go all the way down to the bottom, lines 18, 19, and 20, and focus on that. And what this amendment does is move the enforcement from DHS to health professional regulatory boards as defined in the ORS. And again, that's moving it away from an organization that does do enforcement actions on hospitals, but to the enforcement of the providers as opposed to the organization. And so these are submitted for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Representative Maurer moves to amend House Bill 2700 with the -3 amendment. Any objections? I object.
Oh, is this a voice vote? I'm sorry.
May I just make a comment?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank Representative Maurer for putting these forward. These are in response to testimony we heard. And so I've had some time to think about since the testimony. And I was compelled to go stick with how we have it because of the 8 states who have emergency contraceptive statutes. The authority rests with the hospitals. I think that's the proper place. So I will be not supporting these. So I just want to let you know that. Thank you for bringing them forward because I think we should always have a discussion of things that we hear from the testimony.
Thank you. Representative Gilster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also won't be supporting the amendment primarily because in the testimony that we heard the other week when we discussed this issue was the importance of the providers of the hospitals having in place the policies and procedures that would ensure that the service was provided to women in need when they came following a rape or sexual assault. So I think that it's important to keep that authority resting with the hospital, who will be working with the providers to make sure that the environment exists in which the intent of the law can be followed.
Thank you. Representative Gelser. Susan, would you take the voice vote, please?
Sure.
Cowan?
No.
Representative Gelser?
No.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
No.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
No. The motion to amend the bill, the amendment fails. So, Representative Maurer, you want to talk with us about Dash 4 amendments?
Right. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2700 be amended with the Dash 4 amendments.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Madam Chair, the issue has to do with the bill, and in page 2 of the bill, line 27, at least as I read it, says the information regarding emergency contraception be clearly written and easily understood in a culturally competent manner. And culturally competent is a very expansive term in sociological terms, and I believe that for the sake of statute, that we try to clarify as much as we can so that it's our intent of how this is interpreted and not how the agency might interpret it. And so the amendment I've placed forward just says that culturally competent means sensitive to the patient's faith, race, ethnicity, and national origin.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Is there any discussion on this? Are we ready to take Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I saw these amendments, all of these, for the first time this morning, which may be my fault. But I wanted to ask, we didn't have another work group?
No, Representative, we didn't.
Okay. This one is particularly important to me, and I'm not, I think it's very difficult language to hammer out, but I wanted to again register my interest. During the hearing, I mentioned that I would be interested in pursuing an amendment related to this because of the testimony about this issue.
Right.
So I'm pleased to see it. I'm sorry that we didn't. I know you have a full agenda, so I trust you're guiding us through a long session here. But I was hoping to have a work group on this. We didn't, and I think this is a very good attempt at capturing this issue, and I'll be supporting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And after it passes this committee, it will go on the floor, and then it goes to the Senate. So if you have further interest, you might be able to pursue it there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Any further discussion? Are we ready for a vote on this? All in favor of this, of Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2700, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you, Representative Maurer. We're moving on to House Bill, or the Amendment 5, which is, we heard from DCBS, they had some concerns about the insurance issues. I'm sorry, Representative Gilliam, that you weren't able to see these. These did get to your office yesterday afternoon.
Thank you.
But I think that they are pretty self-explanatory. Does anybody want to discuss these, or can we vote on them? Everybody okay with this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
No. Do you want me to go ahead and
sure.
move? Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2700 be amended with the Dash 5 amendments.
All in favor, Representative Maurer moves that House Bill 27 be amended with the Dash 5 amendments. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you, Representative Maurer. The Dash 7s, we heard some testimony. Well, let's hold off on that one. Let's do 8. That would be the easier one. Again, the Dash 5 amendment is from Dash 8, thank you. Dash 8 amendment is another fix from required by the insurance division. So I think this is pretty self-explanatory. Do we need any discussion on this? All right. Representative Maurer, you'll make the motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2700 to be amended with the Dash 8 amendments.
Representative Maurer moves the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2700. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you. Dash 7, we heard testimony last week when we heard this bill about some religious exemptions, and so we have these amendments drawn up. I think most of you have had a chance to look at them. Any discussion on this,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move that House Bill 2700 be amended with the dash 7 amendments.
Any discussion?
Yes, I just wanted to say that, you know, given the testimony that we heard, I think, you know, this is a reasonable attempt to accommodate specific religious employers, and I support this. So.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? The dash 7 amendments have been moved to 2700. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. All right. Now. I would happy to have someone amend or pass 2700 as amended to the floor with the do pass recommendation.
Representative who?
Oh.
You go. Okay, great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2700 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2700 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I just want to make one comment, and this was not an amendment, but I want to ensure that this is in the record. It's regarding Section 5.2b, which happens to be line 24. What it says, or 23-24, Director of DHS, in collaboration with community sexual assault programs and other relevant stakeholders, may approve informational materials developed. I just want to ensure that the intent of this group is that we, relevant stakeholders, again, is a loose term, and that we ensure that we include faith-based organizations or religions that may need to accommodate this in a sensitive manner.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Susan, would you call the roll, please?
Ms. Allen?
Aye.
Representative
Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Gillian?
Aye.
Representative
Hickett?
Aye.
Representative
Maurer? Aye. Representative Olson? Aye. House Bill 2700, as amended, has passed. And Representative Rosenbaum and I will be the carriers, and I would appreciate it if you would be the first speaker after that.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Great. Thank you very much, committee. Hard work, and we appreciate all that you've contributed to this committee and this bill. Okay. I closed the, oh, no, I didn't close. I closed the work session on 2700. And okay, I open up the public hearing on House Bill 2180, and I open up the public hearing on House Bill 2469.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to take note that because floor session is early today, we're starting at 10. I know there's some individuals who might be here that could not possibly come back on Friday for testimony on either of these bills. And I was wondering if we could make sure that the opening presentations keep in mind the time. And I don't know if it would be helpful for committee staff to know who is not able to come back on Friday so we can prioritize them for today. Because I believe we might have some folks who would have trouble getting back here.
There is somebody from Ashland. And I always ask if somebody has traveled further than 100 miles. Thank you. And if it's difficult, I'm going to put the list back there. If it's difficult for you to come back tomorrow, could you please note that, and we'll try to call on you today.
Friday,
I mean. Yes, thank you. All right. So I think we have a panel of people who are scheduled to speak. Representative Kotek, Aaron Kelly Seal from the Governor's Office, and I have forgotten your name, sir. I'm sure I've got it here. Vic Todd.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm Governor Ted Kulongoski's Human Services Policy Advisor. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of the redesign of Oregon's temporary assistance for needy family programs and the two bills under your consideration by which to do that. Both these bills represent really the most significant opportunity in about a decade to create a new vision for Oregon's self-sufficiency program that serves 18,000 families of our 18,000 of our most needy families, including over 30,000 children. Since he took office, the governor has made every effort to realign the focus of our temporary assistance for needy family programs to remind policymakers, stakeholders, and the public that TANF is really a program that benefits children. It's a children's program, not just a work participation for low-income adults. The governor and, frankly, our federal delegation, particularly Senators Smith and Wyden, also have spent a considerable amount of time trying to remind our federal partner in this program of that fact. But I think, as you heard from the Oregon Center for Public Policy on Friday, in February of last year, the federal government took a different direction with the Deficit Reduction Act, and is now requiring even more, is focused even more strictly on compliance and work participation, even at the risk, unfortunately, of destabilizing families. When the Federal Deficit Reduction Act passed last year, Oregon, like every state in the country, had a choice to make. We could either limited changes in our program, penalize families and their children, reduce even further the numbers of people that we serve so that we strictly meet the letter of the federal law, or we could stay focused on a more holistic family stabilization and economic security-based model, creating new program elements and making some additional state-funded investments in the parents and children TANF serves. That way we could not only meet the federal requirements, but also meet the needs of low-income children and their families. We chose the second approach. And I want to just spend a quick second telling you why and then turn it over. I mentioned earlier that even before the DRA passed, the governor was focused on TANF as a children's program. And that focus for him was driven by a couple of things. One was that we learned when looking at the data that somewhere between 25% and 30% of Oregon's foster children were previously within 12 to 18 months on our TANF program, which means that for whatever reason, the state program was not meeting the needs of those children and their families, and unfortunately then, we ended up in a place where families were separated, children and their children were separated from their parents, and the state was in a position of paying $14,000 to $16,000 a year for foster care for a child that it might not otherwise have had to spend. The second issue is looking at the data coming out of the Oregon Food Bank. And again, between 35 and 40% of the recipients of emergency food boxes at the Oregon Food Bank are children. And what this said to us is that low-income and working families are really having a very difficult time in Oregon today meeting their basic needs, housing, childcare, transportation, and what's suffering as a result is their ability to buy food. And that is impacting our children. And so as we looked at this biennium and the opportunities it presents to strengthen families, keep children safe at home where that's possible, the governor is putting forward for your consideration as a legislative body several different things. The Healthy Kids Plan is one, additional addiction treatment and prevention, particularly targeted toward children and families either at risk of entering or in the child welfare system already. Investments in Healthy Start and relief nurseries, investments in child care for low-income families, investments in more affordable housing, and what we're here to talk about today, investments in a program in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program. All of these investments are really designed to improve family economic stability, to improve educational outcomes for kids, to keep kids at home with their parents when they can be there and be safe, and to reduce the state spending on costly services like foster care, hospital emergency departments, and corrections. That's where these bills really come into play. They're a key part of that continuum of investment that I think is a real opportunity. And these bills, the last point I want to make, were born out of a 6 to 9 month process that the Department of Human Services led that included legislators, included community partners that actually provide services to these families and their children in the community, and included advocates. The group was called the TANF Oversight Committee, and they took a look at the current program, its strengths and weaknesses. They looked at the federal requirements under the Deficit Reduction Act, and then they were charged to make recommendations about a program that would that would produce the best outcomes for children and their families and comply with the new federal requirements, so meeting both those goals at the same time. They adopted principles to guide their work, and the new policy and program elements of those principles are reflected in the bills that you're considering, 2180 and 2469. In a moment, I'm going to turn it over to the representative to talk about the program elements, but I just want to emphasize a couple of things. For the most part, these two bills are more similar than they are different. They create a framework for this program, and they're totally aligned in the creation of that framework. There are a few policy differences that the committee will need to consider, and we're really open to considering those and having some further discussion about them as well. And really, I think probably, you know, ultimately what the discussion will need to be about with the legislative body is really some of our ability to support this program financially. The real driver behind the distinction, I think, between the two bills was that as the governor was creating his recommended budget and balancing it, we only had so much to spend. And so we feel like with House Bill 2180, the department's bill, we were able to really capitalize and provide a framework for our first phase of a very much stronger program than we have in place today that would meet the federal requirements and better support families. And House Bill 2469 takes that to the next level for your consideration so that you can see those two degrees of implementation. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to share the governor's perspective on this bill and its importance, and thank you for the time you're spending on it. Again, this is really one of the most significant opportunities the state has had in over 10 years to focus on the creation of a program that will have a long-lasting and very significant impact on our children and families in this state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly Seal.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm state representative for House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I'm very pleased to be here today. This is an important day, a start of an important discussion for the most vulnerable children in our state. I want to thank the governor and Erin Kelly Seal in particular for her work on this issue and the department, because I think what you'll hear today is that we have two pieces of legislation that are complementary, that have the same goal in mind, to best serve our children and their parents in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. We have not really looked at this program significantly since we started the Oregon option in 1994. We were ahead of the curve in terms of welfare reform, which hit the national scene in 96. Often federal regulations are more challenged than assistance. And in this case, we really have an opportunity. The federal government has made some changes that we have to meet. And so now we have an opportunity to strengthen our program. And the goal is to strengthen this program as a child-centered, child-focused, with the best outcomes for the children in mind. And that means helping their parents. But at the end, we don't want to lose sight of what we're really trying to do, which is provide stability and future security for the children in those families. So we have two bills before us today, and I think I just want to point out that we have this primarily more of a timing issue, and maybe I had an opportunity to add some things into my bill, 2469, which built on what came out of the Oversight Committee. I actually did serve on the Oversight Committee in my role in my previous employment as a child advocate. We were on a very tight timeline to come up with these bills. So you'll notice even in the agency bills, there's a lot of amendments that need to be made. These are very complex issues. So what we've prepared today is a side-by-side comparison. And has that been passed out? Oh, that's okay. There's a side. It's 8 pages because we tried to keep it, you know, short. but to do a conceptual side-by-side comparison of the bills to help you along, you know, this is something we'll probably have to go to work group to work out the details, not only the policy ends of things, but, you know, how are they going to affect us fiscally. And I just want to commend the department. They've been very open about sharing their perspectives, looking at both bills. With caveat, I didn't have a chance to share this with the department. It was kind of last minute last night when we finished it up. So if there are some errors from their perspective, that's all my fault. But to get back to the goal in mind, in House Bill 2469, you'll see some things that are different from the department. And I took the luxury of some time to look at the research and some best practices in other states to say, if we're going to redesign the program, if we're going to have additional investments, what's working in other states? What can have better outcomes for families? We have not done as good a job as we could with our program. A lot of that was resource issue. But now we have a chance to fix some of that. And I would just encourage everyone to be open-minded about how we look at this program, how what we're doing now, and what are our opportunities to change that. And with that, I think I'll just maybe the department would like to make a few opening comments, and then we can go through the sections of this document, and that might help with the discussion of both bills.
Chairman Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, Administrator for the Self-Sufficiency Programs. And I will just, I won't make any opening comments. I think both Representative Kotek and Aaron have covered really the scope in terms of the nature of what we've done in the last 6 to 9 months and really what these bills represent. It really is an opportunity to step away from the existing program that was designed in a different environment and look at the client groups we have at this stage of TANF, if you will, and really design the program around that framework. So with that, I think I'll let you begin to
thank you, Ben. Walk through. We were going to kind of tag team this, so feel free to jump in with questions. Again, I tried to start
if you do have any questions, just speak up.
So the table starts off with areas of agreement, and as Aaron mentioned, the framework for these changes are very similar. The driving factor behind this is the federal government has imposed stricter work participation rates. In other words, folks in the program, more of them have to be working. We're currently, I believe, around 12 to 15% of folks in the program are working under the new definition of work. Part of the challenge for us has been is that our income limit is so low that once you start working, you're off the program. So that's a challenge that we're trying to deal with these bills. So I'm just going to start off with, we currently serve one and two parent families in our TANF program. The federal government is requiring that if we serve two parent families, that 90% of them have to be working. There's agreement that that's an unrealistic target. There was a lot of discussion in Congress about how unrealistic that was. If you have a two-parent family in a program, there's probably barriers, there are issues, and to assume that they are going to participate in regular work is really daunting. So both bills talk about setting up a state-funded only two-parent program. By using state-only funds, we essentially remove that population from having to calculate their work participation rates. As you can see from the numbers on the left-hand column, it's a pretty small part of our TANF population, but it's a significant part in terms of trying to move those families to self-sufficiency. Vic, do you want to, am I getting that right? Okay, you just nudged me if I'm
excuse me, Madam. Mm-hmm.
Representative Maurer.
Representative Kotek. So, just so I'm understanding, if you don't take any money from the federal government, even though it's only 10%, I mean, you're saying you're just taking it off the table, basically.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. This is a critical point, so thank you for the question. Sorry I didn't go into it. So what we're trying to achieve with these bills is to figure out how we can best serve the populations and their ability to reach the work participation rates. And it depends how we use the money. If we are using federal TANF dollars, then those populations that receive those dollars are subject to the work participation rates as imposed by the federal government. If we are able to carve out tracks to serve other populations with state-only funds, then they are being served, but they are not. We do not have to count them towards those higher participation rates.
Is there a telephone book full of regulations that also go by the wayside as a part or as a reality? That
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, this part of the proposal really is trying to address the issue around the 90% participation. Beyond that, what 2180 is proposing is essentially you would have an identical program, except that the people who would otherwise be mandatory for the TANF program would be moved to the state-only program, and from a funding standpoint, the funding would be 100% state funds. And in that way, while you have the same programmatic requirements for those families, they don't fall under the federal requirements with respect to participation requirements. And so you avoid that potential penalty issue that will result from failing to meet the participation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
May I? I'll just direct it to you, my colleague, Representative Kotek. So, if you carve that group out, they are no longer in the TANF program, correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, it might be a semantic issue. At least in my head, it's more of a different track. They're still served by TANF. To me, it's an accounting issue now. In the department's bill, there might be a compelling need to actually state in statute that it is going to be state-funded. But when I always try to think of this, how it works for the family when they come in the door. It's transparent to them. They don't know which funds they're using. So if they're a two-parent family, they will be in the TANF program, except we will be paying for them with state dollars versus TANF dollars.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And in that regard, we're not on shaky ground with the federal funding. This will be a recognized sort of mechanism to on part of the feds.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam. That is my understanding that my impression is other states might be considering this as well. It's completely within our purview. We have a lot of flexibility with our TANF program. How we use the federal dollars connected with that, that's where the regulations and the restrictions come in. But in terms of how we want to form our own state program, we have a lot of flexibility. The issue comes down to how do we fund the different sections of it.
Last one.
Follow up.
And then how does that group compare from a financial standpoint? How much is that going to cost us to pull them out and pay just out-of-state funds relative to the whole program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, there's actually no new costs associated with this action, as that program currently is budgeted within the TANF program. It's just how those revenues are applied. And so we have included it as part of 2180 because it is a commitment of state funds for a particular purpose. And we intend is to establish a state-only two-parent program, essentially.
Okay.
And to follow up real quickly, we do have some state funds in our TANF program now. It's not all federal dollars, so it's a matter of clarifying how we spend those dollars within the existing program to deal with some of these new regulations.
Sorry, because I didn't get my question answered. So because I don't understand this fully, block grants come pretty much there aren't that many strings attached. And in this case, the string attached is the work participation rate.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I would actually say that there are a lot of strings attached to this particular block grant, and more so after the Deficit Reduction Act.
Right, so that was my question. My question was, when you peel these people out, these two-parent families, do you say, well, throw away the regulations because we're funding it? I mean, I would almost think that's an advantage because then you can mold the program how you see fit.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, if I could just maybe try to answer that question. I think what you heard Mr. Todd say is that would be a choice that the state could make, that we could decide to operate this program significantly different way for these families because it is technically funded just with state dollars and we aren't then beholden to the block grant issues. But in this case, the bill is not proposing to do that. It's proposing to keep these families in the program that we otherwise call TANF. And what we're really trying to address with this particular piece of the proposal is the issue that we want to avoid those federal penalties for this group of families not meeting that participation rate. So I think the answer, the clean answer, so yet the one word answer is yes, but that's just not the approach taken in this particular proposal.
Okay.
And if I may, Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, the way I'm looking at this is we're going to approve the whole program. And so the two-parent families, one-parent families, everyone is going to have the advantage of a strengthened program. It's just the fiscal issue more than anything else. So we're going to get to some of that hopefully with the entire program redesign. But thank you for the question. So on page two, the other area of similarity between the bills is creating a state-funded track for individuals with disabilities who are likely eligible for Supplemental Security Income, SSI, and helping those individuals in a track that might better fit their needs. And this might be better if Mr. Todd explains it. I don't think this is a little bit outside my expertise.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, this particular piece of the program is really stems from a lot of the discussions that we had both with staff and with the Oversight Committee with respect to the client needs that exist and really the current level of effort that goes on around moving some of these clients towards SSI eligibility. And so it interrelates with ultimately how much difficulty people have working through the employment and training portion of the TANF program, and that people with very significant barriers obviously have a more difficult time with that. The purpose of this program is twofold. One is to strengthen the effort around that eligibility process in terms of SSI, and also accompanying that with appropriate activities for the families to maintain the family stability while they are in pursuit of the SSI eligibility. By creating this as a state-only program, it then removes this population from the issues around the federal grant with respect to participation. This particular portion of the population has a hard time meeting the participation requirements, even under the old program, if you will, in terms of the Oregon option, although we had more flexibility in terms of them, in terms of the amount of activities they would be in. With the Deficit Reduction Act participation requirements and definitions around activities that count, that would almost be impossible. And so that the purpose of this is really to create a path for them that's more appropriate.
A resident, Colin.
I would just add that...
Could we ask a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, in this whole side-by-side, I don't care which bill, would it include assistance for individuals trying to apply for SSI to help with the required medical exams that they need to get through that application process?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, generally, yes. That is either through our own efforts or through working with the Developmental Disability Services.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a section that I have some questions about, and I'm wondering through this process, if you have a parent or an individual that comes through and there's concern that the individual has a disability that might be impeding the ability to gain employment, what protections would be there to not automatically send that person into the SSI track and to make sure that they're receiving appropriate employment supports, recognizing that people, even people with significant developmental disabilities, do have the ability to be employed, and how do we make sure that we provide them that assistance to be able to obtain gainful employment, which many people with developmental disabilities tell me they want assistance becoming employed.
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, thank you for the question. This is completely voluntary to begin with, so there's a sense of it. The goal here is that to have the, and we'll get a little bit to this a little later, but the idea of that upfront assessment and screening really is meeting the individual needs of the applicant. And that might be saying, yes, I would like to go down this track because I believe that having the SSI income, while I'm also participating in some activities while I'm going down that path, is the best choice for me. And my understanding, this would be, I really, you know, can't stress enough, this is voluntary. There's not going to be a sense of trying to channel people into a track just because we're going to get reimbursed from the federal government later. It's really about what meets the best needs of the client.
Great. And can I follow up?
Follow up.
I think the reason that I keep raising this concern is that for people with disabilities and developmental disabilities and in the disability advocacy community, one of the great barriers and challenges that's faced is the idea that people with disabilities are not employable. And I just kind of want that on the record, that this isn't an intention to say that people with developmental disabilities or physical disabilities aren't employable, that in fact they are, and we can do more to be supporting them to be able to gain employment.
Representative Maurer, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. In 2469 says requires DHS to contract to provide support. First question, is 2180 have that piece in it?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I don't believe so. And the reason I put it in my bill was, we have seen best practices in other places that having that assistance from a nonprofit who have some expertise, maybe more experience because they're dealing with it a lot, that's a critical piece to making sure this happens quicker.
I guess my experience. Follow up. Yes, ma'am. My experience with veterans, like Paralyzed Veterans America, they are a nonprofit, provide support for veterans going through disability, and that's a huge piece. I personally went through that process with my first wife, and it was a huge help. And so, because there is no way that the average person is going to be able to navigate the system, and I'm assuming that the SSI process is similar. Is that an accurate?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, that's been my impression, and you know, I wouldn't assume also that DHS staff would necessarily have that expertise. So why not go to the folks that have the best chance of, you know, who have the most experience with it?
Yeah. Okay.
Colleagues, we have what I'd like to do is have you talk for another 15 minutes. As I think we stated earlier, we have to be on the floor at 10 o'clock this morning. So I'm going to have you talk for 15 more minutes, and then we have Rosemary Lazari. I think she might have just gone out. Kathy Kaufman. Patty, where's Patty Whitney? You can come back on Friday.
Yeah.
You can.
That's okay. I can submit the
testimony. All right. Yeah, because we'll be hearing this probably more than once more. Emily Katz. You can't be back on. Oh, we're going to take you off that list then. Doesn't mean we won't call on you later. And Tom Suing, is it Suing? Can you come back on Friday, Tom?
We'll give you a definite
maybe. We'll hear from you today then. So you bet.
Thank you, Judge.
Oh, and Ian Finch, can you come back on Friday, Ian? Okay. And Cindy Duran. All right, we'll hear you today, then. There were two more on that list from out of town who cannot come back on Friday. All right, we'll try to get to everybody, and we'll just ask people to speak quickly or give us written testimony. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. One of the things that might be helpful is when committee members have a chance to look through and read all the parts of this document. If you have specific questions about the differences, mm-hmm. then get it to us, and we can maybe respond in one-on-one or back in writing, because this is, unfortunately, very complex, and you're all going to get to know a lot more about TANF. So, post-TANF program on page 3. So this is the third large piece. So we're getting. So here's the issue with our program is, because of our income eligibility limits, if you work at minimum wage for more than half time, you make too much money to be on our TANF program. So one of the ways of trying to capture the more workers in the program for our work participation rate is to help folks who are leaving TANF, often called TANF leavers, obviously, who have left the program because of employment, to get a little bit of help from the state, and by expending some maintenance of effort dollars, we can then count those individuals who are working and still getting some level of state support towards our work participation rates. So both bills look at creating a post-TANF program that's funded with maintenance of effort state dollars. Because it's maintenance of effort, we can count their working towards the work participation rate. So this is a critical piece. It also, and the goal is to provide a monthly stipend for up to 12 months, child care, other wraparound services to help people retain work so they're not coming back in the program. So this is a significant part of how we're going to get at that, reaching our 50% work participation rate. The next section is return to work activities after childbirth. Currently, a parent who's given birth, within 3 months, they need to be back into the jobs program. And both bills talk about exempting that to 12 months. There's some differences in the bills in terms of one of the challenges with federal regulation is there's a lifetime limit of the 12-month exemption. So let's say you're a parent and you have a child and you're in the program but you're not back in work for 12 months, but then for some reason you get back on the program and you have another infant, you could not use that 12 months using federal regulations, using federal dollars. The state, however, could choose to cover that parent who's come back into the program with state dollars. They just could not use federal dollars for that 12 additional beyond the 12-month exemption. Page four is client engagement, sanctions, disqualification section. This is probably the area of the two bills that there's some philosophical differences of how to engage clients. And honestly, I it might make sense for you to read it and then have come back and talk about it. But it's essentially, you know, what's our existing policy for engaging clients? You know, if we engage folks up front, provide better case, you know, individualized case plans, do we get better engagement? Do we need a stick? Do we need sanctions? There's just some differences here in the bills, and I don't know if Mr. Todd wants to say anything, but it's a longer discussion. So. On page 5, definition of dependent child, 2469 removes what is known as the deprivation criteria. And why I did this was I really think this is a definition that creates an incentive for families to split up, because if you have, it's depending on how many parents are in the household. Again, this is a very technical issue, and this was not proposed by the agency, but I think it's a one way of not creating some distinctions between one or two parent families. And we could have someone from Legislative Council explain that further if that would be helpful. Time limits. Here in the state, because we had a waiver for our program, we had a rolling 24-month time limit on our TANF program. The new federal regulations will require a 60-month time limit. So both of these bills put that into statute. The differences in the bills are the way we deal with exemptions. Again, we can exempt a certain portion of our TANF population who reached their 60-month time limit for a variety of reasons as articulated in both bills. Again, the question is, how much can we do using federal dollars? How much can we do using state dollars? So there are some differences between the bills in that area. Page 6, child support. We had a little discussion on this last week when we had the informational hearing. The goal in 2469 is to encourage some of the child support collected on behalf of TANF parents to be passed through to the families. We have research that shows that improves child support participation as well as outcomes for the families. That will be a discussion around some fiscal discussion that I think we're going to have to hammer out. Page 7, attempts to describe a very complicated program very quickly, around case management, how we're assessing clients now, what we hope to do differently. Again, the key part in both of these bills, and they're articulated slightly differently, but I think we share the goal that research has shown that if we need to better assess and screen folks when they come in the door and continue to assess them as they move along in the program to make sure that their individual needs are met in a way that they can be fully engaged and be fully successful. And my bill goes as far as listing some of the work activities that would be included under jobs to provide some clarification about what we could possibly do in the state in terms of work activities. But again, I think the key point is that upfront screening assessment issue. And then finally, there's 2469 takes out what I consider some housekeeping, takes out a community work provision, and because we deal with it in a previous section. So those are the main parts of the bill, and I don't know if you have any final comments. Again, reading it over and then getting direct questions back to us, so when we're in the work group, we can then get back to you with answers, I think it might be the easiest way to do that.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I think what we'd like to do is appreciate what Representative Kotek has done in putting this together, and what we'd like to do is be able to give her some feedback on both what the 2180 provisions do and also some comments around current program to be sure that we've got that clear for you, and then use that with the work group going forward.
Perfect. Thank you.
Ms. Kelly, see you.
Chair, to me, members of the committee, I think the other thing that strikes me as we're having this conversation that might be helpful for you that we can certainly put together is a little bit of a diagram of what this looks like for a family who comes in the door, what it would look like today and the options that we have in the current program, and what we're proposing around the pre-TANF, the screening, the ongoing TANF, the post-TANF program, and then on, you know, sort of a side, which elements of that would be state-only funded and therefore have a little more flexibility in terms of our ability to work with and around some of the federal referral requirements, and what program elements that we are currently planning for in the redesign that really are so critical to us meeting the current federal requirements for the federal dollars that we do receive. Because I really want to leave the committee with the strong impression that what these bills do is really two things. One is they meet the technical, they best position the state to meet the technical requirements of the federal law around the block grant of federal money that we currently receive. But they also best position the state to meet the needs of these low-income children and their families. And so doing those things together was very important in terms of the focus as the state moves forward, and we just appreciate the opportunity to keep the discussion going with you all about how to do that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any last questions, colleagues? Excellent panel. Yes.
One quick comment. In this discussion, the technological piece that we talked about, representing Kotek, is this like a join to it somehow? You know, I guess the department.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. Oh, the IT discussion we had last week. You know, I don't know. We'll look into that. I'm assuming there's. How do we make this work so we don't have additional IT needs? I think that's something we have to keep in mind. Absolutely.
Any last questions? Thank you so much. Excellent panel, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future. We've got 5 extra minutes. So let me see. Who should I call up first? Rosemary Lazari.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a panel coming up 3 at a time. Did you have somebody with you? Oh, but you're not speaking.
No.
Okay, come on up, Rosemary. Ian Finch and Cindy Duran.
I'm sure to make into the record. Are they?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, sir, did you want to be on the panel also?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Just pull up another chair. Do they pull up? Yeah, they're... I think they're all okay. Is there something we can pull another chair over? Thank you. Okay, we're going to give you about 2 or 3 minutes because we've got other people who are wanting to speak also. So I just tell me how you want to start. Go ahead.
I'll just introduce myself. My name's Rob Potter. I'm the chair of the Family Service Review Commission. I live in Beaverton. And I wanted to submit our written testimony.
Great. Just give it to Susan over there. Okay, Rosemary?
Good morning, Chair Tomei and representatives. I'm also here as a representative of the Family Services Review Committee. I actually wear very many hats in my life, and my position on the committee, the commission, is as a former recipient, and that's what I want to speak to today. Actually, one of my other hats is as a client advocate in the system now to help other clients go through the system. I was originally on what was called Aid Dependent Children, I think back, Families and Dependent Children, back in the late 80s when I had my first son. That was a very different scenario than when I went back into the system after a DV situation. When I had 3 children about 6 years ago. The process that I went through 6 years ago...
Rosemary, you can be back a little bit from the speaker.
The process that I went through 6 years ago when I went to a DHS office for aid, I went through an extensive assessment program that involved community partners, and in that process, we had what was called a team decision meeting where... we weren't just talking about whether or not I was going to get money. They really addressed what were the barriers to my employment and what my family needed to succeed. And I'm happy to say that it was a life-changing event for me. And I went back to school, completed my degree, and now I'm working to help other clients. And I believe that the assessment program that DHS is putting forth is kind of based on that model of extensive assessment and really addressing needs of the clients. And the other piece that I wanted to speak to is the post-TANF piece that they're introducing as a new piece, which would help clients actually make the transition to the workforce, which it is very challenging to go from receiving a lot of services to actually starting to make money in the workplace. You actually start losing services as you're working, and sometimes it looks better to stay on the services in some ways. And so the incentive to have the grant continue for a little while to help people make the transition, I would really like to speak in support of.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Ian Finch. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm a former TANF client, and I'm a single father with 5 children, varying in ages, and I was able to get TANF because I wasn't working, and I'm also a drug addict who's in recovery, and the children's mom is in prison, so she wasn't in the household, and we divorced. So I had worked in getting my children back from the state, and I got them back, and then I was on TANF, and they made me go look for a job 40 hours a week, and I had supervision requirements through probation and parole, and also my drug and alcohol treatment to keep me clean and sober so I could father these 5 children. And I don't feel like the assessment process gave me that wraparound service that I needed. And through perseverance and volunteering, I was able to get a job. And then when I got a job, it was only $8 an hour. And I have 5 children to support. So, I mean, you could really do the math and figure out $8 an hour is not going to go very far when you're supporting 5 children. And so the post-TANF support would have been really helpful, because I almost felt, and I told my employer this, I'm like, oh, this is really scary for me because, you know, I took this job and it's great that I'm working and stuff, but it was almost like I had more services when I was on TANF. And, you know, now I have 5 children I need to have child care for, and I have a co-payment and just all that other stuff. So maybe if there was some help in that transition process, because it was a big transition for both my children and I, and there was things like my daughter wanted to do dance, and I just couldn't afford to even buy her dance shoes because my budget was so tight, and I don't want my kids just hanging out. You know, I want them involved in activities, and I kind of wanted them to have a fair chance just like any other kid. And so not only the stress of, you know, that, you know, it is like I needed to stay on top of my recovery, too, because I am an addict, and I need to stay on top of that first and foremost so I can be a father to my children and I can be there for them and kind of show them a different life. But it was through a lot of perseverance that I had to take, you know, and the support wasn't necessarily there as the wraparound service like I think that we could create as a community. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Dren, and I am a parent advocate with the Center for Family Success in St. John's. I'm also a recovering meth addict, and also had 3 years of incarceration at Coffee Creek. When I came out of incarceration, with my criminal convictions, I wasn't able to just go and find employment. When I went to apply for TANF, later I was told that also that I needed to be doing job search for 40 hours a week, yet I was waiting to enroll at Chemeketa. And because I was going to be receiving financial aid, I didn't qualify for TANF at that point. So I wasn't put on into that program till later, once I graduated from Chemeketa and I started working, like Ian mentioned also, the services just went down. I went from a $25 copay to a $300 copay. I also had to pay for gas. I was living in Salem and working in Portland. You know, so just those extra funds weren't there. But struggling to do it anyways, because I know that at the end, me working and being employed full-time is going to benefit my children. But those services do go down. Services such as food stamps also going down from, you know, $600 a month. I have 5 kids, $600 a month down to $200 a month monthly, and it seems like they're just cut off automatically instead of there being a progression, you know, gradual, so you're getting used to doing those sorts of things when you haven't been employed for 10 or 15 years and coming back into the community and the workforce, having to buy clothes and, you know, do childcare and all of those sorts of things. So I really support this and the changes that are included in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Cindy spoke with us a couple of years ago about meth, addiction to meth, and I think that was the first time that it was a little, the committee was somewhat different, Health and Human Services, and you spoke to us, and that was the first time, I guess, that I really had a sense of what meth addiction was like. You did a very wonderful presentation that day, and it might be appropriate for this committee, if we have time, sometime maybe, to have you and other folks who are recovering, and I congratulate both of you for your recovery, and I can imagine how difficult that is, and so glad that, to see that you're doing well. So thank you all for coming. Do we have any quick questions?
Just like to say thank you for coming.
Yes,
you did an excellent job.
And yes, and good luck on your recovery and your work with your children. And so glad that you have your children still with you and you're still operating as wonderful parents. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to call up Kathy Thompson, Patricia Perry, and Tom Suing. Is there anybody else that we need to hear from today? Okay. Please go ahead.
My name is Kathy Thompson, and I've been on TAMP for, I guess, in the early 90s. And I'm a mother of five. Three are living with me, two are not, and a grandmother of two. I like to just say this. I'm a dislocated student. I've been in school for a year and 1 month. As of February 1st, 2007, I was told by DHS that if I did not participate in the jobs program, my child care and my TAMP will be taken away. Mind you, during that process, I had children that were sick. And at the same time, I was trying to be successful in my associate's degree as a fine artist. During that process, I tried to come to agreements with my caseworker that I've been doing this for a year and a month, and I have been persistent, and I followed all of DHS's required policies and did everything in my nature to keep them abreast of what was going on in my family. She said, I understand, Kathy, but the system does not support a higher education. Again, I repeat, I was in it for a month. How can you take me away from something that I was persistent in and being successful at it to support my family? All along, during me fighting that, from February to February 14th, I had to withdraw from school. Not on my own, mind you. It was to salvage my child care and my TAMP grant. That hurt me because I had a goal, and my goal was to be successful and to get a degree in my family because I'm the only child. I went as far as to go and to obtain some advice from an attorney of mine, and she helped me out to get the situation straight. During that process, she had mentioned to my attorney that either she goes to orientation for the second time, not the first, the second time, that it will be taken away from her. It did get taken away for a week because I, out of desperation, signed a trap to the TriMet card to take my child to the doctor because I needed that. And at the same time, working with DHS for the work experience to still stay in school to do work study as work experience. They agreed upon that. They told me that I could do that. During that process, I'm still thinking, why are you taking this away from me? This is for me and my family. It's for me to become, as you say, self-sufficient. That is the goal, right? That is the goal. That is what you are there for me, to help me and my family to be self-sufficient. How can I be self-sufficient if I'm not persistent what I've been continued to allow to do? She said, well, that's policies. I understand policies, but policies don't intertwine with persistence. I'm in Project Enterprise, and I've been there for like a couple of weeks now. I am still receiving my child care, but I have difficulty with the accommodations they have. It's hard for me to get a TriMet card. It's hard for me to obtain the necessary accommodations to keep going and being in Project Enterprise and working with work experience. Now, mind you, work experience doesn't work for me because I had a journey and I was following through with it. It's just that I was taken out of it because of another caseworker's faith in me and the decisions I made in my life. It is hard for me to accept to this day that I will have to continue school on another note. I'm required to continue to go to work experience for the next 2 months until I come up with a job, either it's part-time or full-time. And that's what keeps me keeping my child care and salvaging my TAM, which is the only thing that I live off of, which is only $6.30. And it's, as they say, it's only $2 something an hour, which is pretty, that's not even livable. I'm here to let you know that I am a client who is doing as I am told, yet put against the wall and having to jump through loops to keep the things that are most important for a single mother and her children, and that is to keep that child care and to keep the TAMF coming in until I am self-sufficient to be able to support those areas of my life on my own. There's not much I can say, and I'm sure I'm not the only voice that can be convincing to you, and that I will not be the last voice. And I'm sure that during the process of this whole ordeal, maybe there will be something good out for the single mothers and the children. I just want you all to know that I am trying to help myself and my family in the most better way, and the most difficult way is with the DHS process. The assessment, I did not get to know about anything within assessment like the DCI program. I'm fighting to be a part of that because, as you know, I've been in school for a year and 1 month, and I'm trying to fight that to get that 1 year that I deserve to continue in school and to continue with my degree. And after that, of course, DHS will not support me anymore with schooling, which I understand. And I will be looking for strong resources to support me on that level. But at least give a mother who is being persistent and who is following the policies a chance to prove that and to get herself off of welfare.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm going to read because I have a hard time remembering, especially when I'm nervous. My name is Patricia Perry, and I have a 10-year-old son, James, and a 5.5-year-old daughter, Champagne, who live with me. I feel very privileged being here today. I have been feeling anxious and frustrated since I had my last review for the Food Stamp and Organ Health Plan programs. Because I was told when Champagne turns 6 years old come July, I will have to start looking for work outside of the home for us to continue receiving those programs. Approximately 7 years ago, I decided I was finally tired of being a junkie and everything else that comes along with that life. And I was tired of not being a mother to my children. I decided to take James and literally run from his abusive father. At that time, I was living in the state of Washington, and They helped us get into an apartment, and I took steps to get into a treatment facility in Spokane with James. While in treatment, I gave birth to my daughter, Champagne. Once we completed that phase of our new lives, we moved here to Albany, where my mother was living with my two older children. We moved in with my mom and all my children together. I began the jobs program. My mom babysat for free while I went to this class from 7:30 in the morning till 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, Monday through Friday. I used her vehicle. I did that for a few months. I had to attend 45 days of this class every day to be considered to get any benefits. Then we were able to move into a drug-infested apartment complex, which we were happy about at the time, by the way, to have our own place. And we were there for about 3 years while waiting for housing to come through. After doing the jobs class for a while, I began working at Limbenton Community College through Voluntary Work Experience Program. That lasted about a year until I began interferon treatments for hepatitis C. I was exempt from the jobs program while on the treatments I took for 1 year, which they did work, but I have a lot of side effects left over from that. When my caseworker wanted me to begin jobs program again, I was in no condition mentally or physically to go back due to my ongoing side effects. So I discontinued receiving the cash grant and kept the food stamps and medical and began getting Champagne's child support. Instead of it going to the state, it came to her. We receive, $460 per month from the child support. After a while, the housing... Okay, I already talked about the housing. Oh, no, I didn't. After a while, the housing came through, and now we live in a nice little three-bedroom house. Our rent is $64 per month at this time. With the food stamps and medical, we are okay. We are poor, but our needs are met. I am able to be at home for my children as a mother, father, teacher, caregiver, homemaker, etc. We are Bible students, and in the evenings when we aren't at Bible study or ministry school, we spend time at the YMCA on a scholarship. I pay $16 a month doing that. James is involved in basketball now, and Champagne has been taking swimming lessons. We all swim together, and also I get time to work out. The idea of losing our food stamps is devastating to us. Even if I could find a job that I am qualified to do, I would be, and it would be flexible enough to deal with my medical problems. The money would be going to Lord knows who to care for my children. James isn't even old enough to be a latchkey kid, which I would hate to have happen. Besides that, my rent would go way up, and my food stamps would probably be minimal. I will be getting nowhere fast for what? So my children can spend less time with their single parent. I do realize that I am the one who had children without being married. But should they have to suffer for that? I truly believe the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. I know that there are people who hate to pay taxes to support people on welfare, but I would hope that people in our country, in our basic culture, would be open to helping some of us that are less fortunate. I personally don't mind helping people in need if I am in the position to do so, and if they are attempting to make good choices. I do feel that welfare reform was a good move, but I would like to see the TANF program not be so cut and dry and black and white. And I hope you can help make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Madam Chair and representatives, Tom Suing. I'm an employment consultant and a certified career development facilitator at Chemeketa Community College. I'm the partner at the North Salem branch of the DHS office, and I work with the clients in the TANF program and what you would refer to as a jobs program. And Representative Kotek, I'm mentally slipping you a high five for what you're doing here today. I'm going to say as much as I can of what I was going to say, but I will not be able to say it as good as what you just heard from these five. I feel right now, honestly, like I'm still at work, because this is not a select few coming in here to make an impression today. This is it day after day after day. What I had planned on saying probably won't have the impact. I guess I would start off with saying that what you're hearing from these five that have spoken before me, believe them and hear what they're saying, because that's true. I came in and was asked specifically to deal with barriers to employment, and they've just rattled off one after another of what I've got on my list. I say, you know, lack of basic education. I don't like here. I mean, is there a group that you can say, get off your lazy rear and go out and get a job? Yeah, I think we all know that. But it's not the majority. It's not the majority at all. This is the majority of people that are busting their tails to get out there and get a job, and it's not that easy. To go out and grab a minimum wage job with lack of education, without a GED or high school diploma, we're going to see them running through the revolving door in our system over and over and over again. I like the idea of the flexibility of the state of Oregon to deal with the circumstances and the market, the job market, and the situations that we're dealing with in Oregon that does not match the needs or the speculations of the federal level. We need that flexibility. Criminal histories are a huge barrier to people. It's not easy just to shove them out the door and say, you know what, go out and get a job. We need the flexibility. We need to be able to put the dollars where they're needed, so that we're spending less on the clients because we've done something and have met their needs and the needs of their families, rather than giving them the minimal and having them follow these hard and fast rules without flexibility, and then seeing them over and over and over and spending tons and tons of money on having them return to the system because we're not doing what it takes to get them out of the system. Long-term unemployment, a newly single parent coming in who's been a stay-at-home mom in particular that has spent 6 or 7 years at home raising kids, that is now a newly single parent. The father figure has left the home, and all of a sudden, here's a single mom that's been out of the workforce for 7 years, and then we expect them to run out into the workforce in the mainstream and get a job and just adapt to that situation right away. That's what's expected from a lot of people, and it's unrealistic. I could give you this whole notebook of some of the unrealistic expectations that we have of the clients who come in the system. Disabilities, they were addressed earlier. Inability to maintain employment for one reason or another. Working, a single mom working that has a sick child or two sick children, nobody to take care of them, what do they have to do? Leave them at home on their own or take time off from work to go stay with them. It would be really easy to get up and kind of rant right now. It's a great opportunity to do that, but I don't need to do that. But I guess my statement to encompass everything that I would say would be to listen to what you're hearing today, and if there's anything that you can do, you know, please do it. Make sure that we have the funding that we still have. At least let us keep that and do what we can with it, and give us some flexibility on the funding that is available so that we can take care of the needs of the people that are right here before us. In closing, and totally off of my semi-script here, is if I put it before you, I can't do it myself. It's not a do as I say, not as I do type of a deal. If I asked everybody in this room, for the next 2 weeks, don't go out for lunch, don't buy your morning coffee, don't go to the coast this weekend, don't go camping this summer, don't register your kids for baseball. I heard about the ballet thing, so we'll replace that with Little League baseball, the same thing. Send your kids to a birthday party without a gift, or don't send them at all. Use the bus for all of your family transportation. Don't use your personal vehicle. And don't go out into your yard. And do that for 2 weeks, and it'll probably drive you nuts. And this is what we're seeing here. This is what the people have to do day after day after day. They don't get to do these things that we take for granted. And, again, just please listen to what the former and current clients of the system are telling you, because they're right on the money. I see thousands every year of these are my clients. I've not worked with any of them personally, but their stories are, that's what I deal with day after day after day, and trying to get them back out in the workforce. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. You're obviously a good advocate for the people that you see. And thank you again for the folks who have come to testify today. We have to be on the floor in about 6 minutes. Yes, Andy's trying to say something to me. Oh, okay. So thank you all for coming. We will have another hearing on Friday, correct? And if any people, did I miss anybody who said they were coming from more than 100 miles or couldn't make it on Friday? Okay. And also, yes.
This woman has.
Okay, did you sign up? Okay, very quickly. 1 minute sounds perfect.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the policy director for Children First for Oregon. We're a statewide child advocacy organization, and I want to commend Representative Kotek for House Bill 2469. We believe that TANF, I want to reiterate, TANF is a children's program. Three-quarters of the recipients of TANF in this state are children. It's a crucial program. Extreme poverty has very serious long-term consequences for kids, and therefore child outcomes and child well-being must be at the forefront of considerations when it comes to making changes to this program. I believe House Bill 2469 does this, and I just want to emphasize the importance of assessment and evaluation with families. Increasing engagement is a concept that we're starting to understand more about in the field of child welfare, and we ought to be doing a better job of it in the field of family assistance. Working with families instead of against them is the only way to ensure that those families will be able to move on and do a better job of taking care of themselves. And this bill goes a long way to encourage the TANF program to do just that. And I also am very pleased to see that this bill will allow child support money to pass through to families. Again, I want to reiterate, the research shows that when money actually gets to the kids, parents are more likely to pay into the system, and that ends up being a good thing for the kids. We think that the component of the bill allowing parents of newborns to remain home up to 12 months rather than 3 months is another good move. It's a newborn is a very stressful time for any family, but especially for families in crisis. And so we believe that this is a good move and will do a better job for those families, allowing them to become more stable before they move out onto the workforce. So that's it. Please support this bill. We think this is the right move. And thank you very much, Representative Kotek, for your work on it.
Thank you very much. Thank you all who came. Thank you who presented written testimony. And we will see a lot of you on Friday. And I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.